Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. So yesterday, the Senate voted to go ahead with the impeachment trial, but all but five Republican senators went along with Rand Paul's motion to declare the entire trial unconstitutional. So the long surrender of the Republican Party to Donald Trump continues even after Donald Trump is gone. We'll talk about this in a little while. If you are a subscriber to Bulwark Plus, you got my newsletter this morning, where I raised the question, what is the excuse now? I mean, I think it's very easy to look at this as, well, you know, same old, same old. This is what the Republican Party has been doing for the last 4 years. But it is different, because my argument is there's really no excuse now. I mean, he's no longer president. There are no judges. There are no tax cuts to be signed, no regulations to be slashed. Mexico is never going to pay for the fucking wall. There aren't even tweets to be afraid of. So, you know, we'd been assured by conservatives and Republicans over the last 5 years that they needed to make this grand bargain, this Faustian bargain with Donald Trump. And that was the necessary price to advance a conservative agenda. So, yeah, you know, Charlottesville was awful. Kids in cages was really terrible. You know, the feckless botch of the pandemic was bad stuff. And so, of course, we had 1,000 off the record interviews of Republicans saying that they were really concerned and upset over his bizarre and erratic behavior and the incitement of white nationalist violence. But this is what they signed up for, because this was the deal, right? I mean, it was worth ignoring all the lies, the corruption, the racism, because Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, you know, Amy Coney Barrett. But see, here's the thing. And again, I make the case in the newsletter. And if you're not a subscriber to Bulwark Plus, please consider doing so. But here's the problem. He's gone now. There aren't going to be any more Supreme Court justices. There are no jobs for buddies. There are no more rides on Air Force One. The Faustian bargain has reached its expiration date. So even if you're Flight 93, you know, believe that, well, you have to storm the cockpit because otherwise Hillary Clinton will destroy America. Well, no, it's not Trump versus Hillary. It's not Trump versus socialism and wokeness. It's not, you know, either Trump alone will save you from a caravan of Mexican rapists. No, it's just naked Trump now. This vote is up or down. So, I mean, really what it's not like you're voting to make Nancy Pelosi president. It's basically drawing a line against sedition. And I think it's rather remarkable that the Republican Party cannot do it. So we have a lot to talk about today. And so we're welcoming back one of our more popular guests, Will Salatin, who is the national correspondent for Slate Magazine. Will, welcome back.
Hey, Charlie. Great to be with you.
Okay, now the reason I wanted you on this week was because of your brilliant piece earlier this week that really I have read several times. The headline is "The Enemy Is Not Republicans, It's Liars," and you make the case for a broad fact-based alliance against fabrications. Now, I assume this is aimed at fellow Democrats, fellow progressives, saying, "Hey, listen, we need to make common cause with some of these conservatives who have not gone completely crazy." Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, it is a plea to liberals, centrists, leftists, whatever, to set aside the traditional left-right arguments. I mean, I'm not saying drop them entirely. They're still there, but there is a more fundamental threat going on, and that is the rise in this country through Trump, but going past Trump, of this sort of dictatorial propaganda where you just lie. You don't spin. You don't accept common facts. You make stuff up. And when you're presented with contrary evidence, you don't try to explain it away. You just deny it. And that didn't used to be the main way of talking in this country, but Trump made it that way. And it obviously is persisting since he's gone. And that is the number one threat. It is in the Republican Party primarily, but it is a national problem. It is an international problem. And all of us who are willing to play by the rules of deliberative democracy, which means at least accept facts when they're clearly real and try to argue about the facts, have to stand together. And that means people on the left, the middle, and the right.
So let me quote you to yourself here for a moment. Politics has become a fight between those who are willing to respect evidence and those who aren't. And you're not saying that Trump's other sins and crimes, the corruption, the bigotry, the treachery, all of this don't matter. But those legacies, awful as they are not as crippling as the damage he has done to our capacity for deliberation on the issues before us. And then you mentioned a whole bunch, you know, COVID, jobs, trade, police reform. There are lots of ideas that could unite progressives and conservatives. But without agreement on facts, or at least on a method of distinguishing facts from lies, we lose our ability to agree on policy. What Trump has brought to the United States is ruthless, relentless, denialist propaganda at a scale we used to see only in dictatorships. And obviously, we've just seen the consequences of that. He proved that tens of millions of Americans would believe such lies, and that thousands would violently attack our own government. Okay, what I think is interesting here is, I've been struggling to articulate this, and I think you did a really good job, that we need to, you know, maybe reconceptualize how we think of politics, at least in the near term, that there's the right-left axis, but there's also a vertical axis, which is truth, lies, liberal democracy versus authoritarianism, and that seems to be more relevant right now, that the issues that really are going to determine where we go as a society are on that vertical axis as opposed to the right-left axis. I'm not saying it's not there. I'm just saying that we need to acknowledge that it is also there and really important. I mean, I think that's one of the points you're making in this article.
Yeah, and actually, I would encourage people to think of this axis of truth or falsehood not so much as an ideological thing, which left right. and right often is. Like we can look at the same information, we can argue it different ways. That can be ideological. This axis of truth and falsehood is not. It's more practical, and practical in the sense that if you and I, Charlie, want to have an argument about policy, and I'll do my job of representing the left, and you'll do your job of representing the right, we at least have the common information to ground us. I can point to it and say, but what about this? And you can say, yeah, but what about that? And we have a method of arguing about reality that can force each of us at various points to say, okay, you got me on that one, that's true, but, all right, that's progress. We can have a conversation that's constructive. But this, if you have people, and it becomes a significant constituency in this country, a driving constituency in the Republican Party at this point, who just don't accept the facts, who you tell them, yeah, but that case, that election fraud argument was already tried in the Ninth Circuit or whatever it was, and they didn't find any merit to it or whatever, you know, it was, there was a recount in Georgia, they checked that out, it didn't turn out to be true. People who won't say okay at that point or accept the fact, nothing can be accomplished right. with them. Right. And so they get in the way of all progress on all issues.
And their beliefs are non-falsifiable. There's no piece of evidence that they can give them. So in Georgia, they had the audit, didn't make a difference. Recount, didn't make a difference. Refuted each and every one of them. So this becomes almost this religious belief. Okay, but given that you can't have a discussion, you can't get anything done, really, what do you do about this? And the reason I'm bringing this up is because you can see that on the right, that you have two things happening. And then this is tragic to me. I mean, I wrote a book called How the Right Lost Its Mind. The right continues to lose its mind. You're seeing the spreading acceptance of, you know, flat out lies, not to mention QAnon conspiracy. I mean, these wild ass conspiracy theories that just make your head explode. You know, you're seeing the rise of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. And yet the other development on the right is the suggestion that if you do anything about this, that you are part of cancel culture, that you are trying to gag people. And I thought Mike Allen had a very interesting point the other day. He said this theme of silencing will be to the modern Republican Party what big government was in the 90s, an all-purpose target designed to inflame feelings of victimhood. So this is also what's happened. So how do you fix this? How do you, what do you do with an ecosystem in which Fox News is in real competition with OAN for who can sling as much bogus bullshit?
You know, I don't have the simple answer. I mean, one answer is, the answer to winning this fight in the long run is just make it hurt to be a liar, to make it politically damaging. And that's difficult when those folks have as much of a grip as they do on the Republican Party. But as to the argument, the sort of Tucker Carlson argument about how this is cancel culture, I think to the best of our ability, we need to drive a wedge between the debate about ideology and the debate about facts, to make clear that this is not an argument that is applied selectively to the right or the left. It is a standard against lying. If you lie, and it is verifiable that you are lying or that you are not accepting evidence presented to you, you're spreading disinformation, we're going to come down on you, because that's a general rule of debate. Now, you do need enough of a culture in the country to accept that, right? You need people to be able to look at this conversation and say, okay, these things over here, these really are facts, right? Yeah. These are just lies. And no, you don't have the same privilege to spread complete lies, especially when you know they're lies, as you would to make an argument for a point of view.
The problem is that it's easy to say this, and I'm really wrestling with this, because you know I tried for many, many years to push back against misinformation and found that it was becoming increasingly difficult as we create these alternative realities. There's no way that we're going to fix this sickness on the right without conservative media taking a constructive role, right? I mean, let's be honest about it. I mean, you know, conservatives are not going to give up on the conspiracy theories and the false stories because NPR tells them to do it, or because Slate tells them to do it, or because the New York Times tells them to do it, right? They're going to have to hear it from trusted voices. And here's the scary thing. And so, Will, you mentioned the Tucker Carlson argument. And I think this is really central. So could you bear me? I want to, let's play what he said the other night. And he's talking about criticism of QAnon. Now, for people, I assume that most of our listeners kind of have a sense of QAnon. I mean, but QAnon is really crazy stuff. I mean, it's you know, the satanic group of pedophiles who drink babies' blood. Marjorie Taylor Greene has even suggested that there are videos of Hillary Clinton, you know, carving off a baby's face. I mean, this is really, really weird stuff. I mean, it is to say that it's toxic doesn't seem good enough. But here's Tucker Carlson on the biggest platform on the right talking about QAnon and the criticism of QAnon. Let's just play this.
The real threat is a forbidden idea. It's something called QAnon.
Next, what to do about QAnon and its droves of loyal followers? Is it too little too late to bring our loved ones back to reality?
Many of those who believe the totally unfounded conspiracies and prophecies of QAnon expected January 20th to be Judgment Day.
As far-right figures and QAnon conspiracy theorists are joined by Trump supporters who believe the election was stolen.
QAnon is better viewed as an on-ramp to various different extremism circles.
How many people in the country have been marinated in these conspiracy theories, QAnon craziness, and it is frightening.
Ooh, Mr. Tom Friedman thinks this is all pretty frightening. And he's right, but not, as usual, for the reasons he thinks. We're watching a profound change taking place in American society, and it's happening very fast. The stakes could not be higher. There is a clear line between democracy and tyranny, between self-government and dictatorship. And here's what that line is. That line is your conscience. They cannot cross that. Government has every right to tell you what to do. Controlling the behavior of citizens is one of the basic prerogatives of any organized society. It's why we have it. Government can try to prevent you from committing murder or rape or from speeding or jaywalking. That's all allowed. It's legitimate. But no democratic government can ever tell you what to think. Your mind belongs to you. It is yours and yours alone. Once politicians attempt to control what you believe, they are no longer politicians. They are, by definition, dictators. And if they succeed in controlling what you believe, you are no longer a citizen. You are not a free man. You are a slave. So yes, Tom Friedman, this is frightening. It's everywhere all of a sudden. No one is pushing back. And so they have almost every one of them, joined the mob of censors, hysterics, and Jacobin destroyers, all working on behalf of entrenched power to take total control of everything.
Okay, so excuse me while I go and put my head in a wood chipper. I mean, so what Tucker Carlson does is he raises QAnon, doesn't describe what it is, what the beliefs are, and then has a couple of clips of people saying that's really, you know, it's bad that people believe crazy stuff. It's actually scary. And before you know it, it's, you know, Tom Friedman says it's scary, but no, what's really scary is what these, you know, Jacobin, what was he? How do you describe, you know, these Jacobin dictator types, like you will, I guess, right?
Yeah. So, Charlie, that rant is so nuts that there is an argument sometimes that rants like that are a sign of progress, that it's a stage of collapse, right? That you don't have anything to argue on the merits. So you're just screaming about my right to believe that the sky is purple or orange or whatever it is. He doesn't really have anything to argue there. It's possible that eventually, you know, that they will just lose that fight since they don't have any, because I've heard much better arguments from the right when there's something serious to argue.
I think it's much worse than this. I'm going to raise the alarm a little bit more here, because there's a fundamental deep dishonesty in Tucker Carlson's argument, because first of all, he's conflating concern about whether something is true or not true with government censorship. There was no suggestion anywhere in any of the clips he played, or by Thomas Friedman, as far as I know, that the government come in and tell you what you can believe, right? So, you know, but part of this is making the victimization, but also it is creating this climate now on the right where to even question the truth or falsity of these absolutely batshit crazy conspiracy theories is somehow part of the silencing or the cancel culture. So, you know, going back to what we've been talking about, if we need to have, you know, a politics that's based on truth, the right's response, at least based on Tucker Carlson's thing, is not going to be, well, that's true or not true. It's going to be, you can't even say that. You're trying to come for us. You're trying to gag us. You're trying to take away our conscience, which, you know, wants to believe that Hillary Clinton does drink the blood of babies and wears dead baby skin masks, because that's America, Will.
Right. So this goes back to the theme that we've been talking about, the distinction between disputes of fact and disputes of opinion or ideology. I completely agree with you that once that distinction is lost, you end up with people invoking conscience as a right to believe just nonsense, you know, batshit conspiracy theories. So that's kind of where the Carlson argument is. Maybe it's because I'm not on the right that I'm not taking it as seriously as I should, that I don't realize that people who think that way control the Republican Party at this point. And that is very disturbing. It makes me think, though, that to come back to a very important constructive idea, what we desperately need is affirmative models of how to be conservative and reality-based at the same time. That may sound a little crazy to people who've been conservative and reality-based all along.
No, that's exactly what you have to have. It's just so rare.
So this goes back to what you said about Will Salatan, Slate, the left, liberals, whatever. We're not going to be able to talk to people on the right. They're just going to point, you know, Carlson, Ted Cruz et al. They're going to point to people like me and say, yeah, that's the left trying to tell you how to think. So what we need is a stable, respected, authoritative right, an elite, if you will, of people who talk about politicians, media, who are authentically conservative, who can say, look, I am against abortion. I am for strong national defense. I am for low taxes. And yet this Q stuff is completely bonkers. And let me show you why. So that the Carlsons can't point to them and say, that's the left telling you what to think. They'd have to say, that's conservatives of a different kind telling you what to think. And those conservatives could then have an argument with the crazy conservatives about whether we're going to be fact-based or not.
No, I agree with you completely. And that's why someone like a Chris Wallace is so important on Fox News. But others like that have been driven out. I mean, I think one of the worst developments is watching Fox putting Maria Bartiromo in prime time, one of the worst of the worst. So this is what bothers me about Tucker Carlson is that this is a role that he could play. He could take that credibility that he has. He could take that audience he has, and he could say, look, you know, we hate all these leftists and all of this stuff and all the stuff you just mentioned, but this is wrong. Do not do this. The fact that he doesn't want to do that says a lot about, I think, his character, but also about the political environment on the right, where, you know, Fox News, I think, is afraid to push back on the lies, on the conspiracy theories, on things like this, because they're afraid that this is what the audience wants, and that if they do, they will lose an audience share to OAN and Newsmax, who are more than willing to, you know, spread this. So the disturbing thing is that what they're trying to do is, instead of saying, let's say we're talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is just absolutely out of her freaking mind. And of course, we're getting these reports now that she talked about the assassination of Nancy Pelosi and killing other leaders and et cetera. And by the way, as I tweeted out earlier today, isn't assassination a form of cancel culture? I mean, since we're talking about cancel, I mean, I would think that that would be a form of canceling. But so rather than saying, you know, is there a place for people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, they're falling back into these people need to be respected. How dare you try to impose your view on them? Because I don't know what else you do about this except to say these people are wrong. And if they won't acknowledge it, we need to disassociate ourselves with them. And quite frankly, you know, I'm a free speech absolutist, but I have to say I don't have a problem with Twitter and Facebook and others saying you do not have a right to lie and spread batshit crazy stuff on our sites. We are a private company and we're not doing it. But of course, this has become the rallying cry about the great silencing, right? I mean, Josh Hawley goes on television every single night now to say, oh, poor me, I'm a victim, I'm being silenced.
Yes, and this highlights one of the most important rules of politics, that is, rules that will actually develop a healthy politics, and it is beware of developing the wrong audience. Beware of cultivating people who will make you, who will attract you to, and will eventually constrain you to tell lies, to cultivate. I mean, this is, I mean, I keep thinking back, I'm from Texas, right? I was a Democrat in Texas growing up, and the Texas Democratic Party died. What happened? The Southern strategy, right? The Republican Party took a bunch of voters from the Democratic Party in Texas and other states and became culturally the majority party. But those people, I don't know how to say this without sounding elitist, they were the wrong audience, right? Mm-hmm. They were racists, and there were some okay people in there, but basically the Republican Party became captive to, and now that those people have just completely lost their minds, and they are the Marjorie Taylor Greene constituency. They are the Trump constituency in a lot of ways. They are, drum roll please, the basket of deplorables. And what happened is the Republican Party became dependent on them. They became so powerful in the party that even the departure of Donald Trump, as you've pointed out, will not make this go away, because that basket of deplorables now dominates the party. Now, when I say deplorable, I don't want to mean these people are unsalvageable, but if you are going to have a healthy political party and you're going to have some of those people in it, you are going to have to lead, something Josh Hawley is unfamiliar with. And leadership means, in part, telling them what they don't want to hear because it is true, because they will have a more productive, healthy life, and certainly a more productive, healthy country if they will accept reality and work with it.
You know, see, this is the question that I have in my mind, is the fear of leadership, the fear of doing something like that. Because what their assumption is that the audience is, that their constituency is so far gone that they need to speak to them in these dumbed down terms, and they need to pander to these fallacies. And if they stood up and said, look, I am with you on these things, we share values, but this is wrong, that they think they will be rejected. Now, I don't know whether they will be, because, I mean, you would think, and maybe this is a sign of my, I still have a little bit of naivete, that people respect someone who treats them with respect and says, look, I want you to be credible. We have the same goals, but this is a lie. This is not true. This hurts your credibility. And plus, it's immoral to be pushing these arguments. You would think that there would be at least some leaders who'd be willing to say that on the right. And there are, but they're vanishingly rare. I mean, we can count them on one hand and still have a couple fingers left over, right? So this is the scary moment. And I think you're seeing it right now. There was that moment right after January 6th where I thought there was going to be that kind of introspection and debate. But boy, the window closed fast, didn't it?
Yeah. Actually, Charlie, you're making me think that I'm being too pessimistic. And I like your way of looking at this better because it leaves open the possibility for reform, improvements, et cetera, that there are a lot of folks who are being played with QAnon bullshit who can be brought around to a more productive, healthier, more sensible way of being conservative. I don't know how to do that. I'm concerned that they haven't shown a willingness to do that. But the other way of looking at it from my sort of writing them off would be instead focusing on the leaders, focusing on the Hawleys and the Cruises and the Tucker Carlsons, Fox News, which literally is captive to this audience, and saying that leaders could improve the situation by speaking more respectfully, as you're putting it, to them. And all I can tell you, Charlie, is I want to see that experiment conducted. I want to see.
I do too.
You know, what if Fox News said, you know what, we're not going to compete with OAN. We're not going to compete with Newsmax. We're going to compete with the mainstream networks, and we're just going to not be biased from a liberal point of view. And let's see what kind of audience we can develop doing that.
No, I thought that there was a possibility that was going to happen, but clearly they've made a different decision. I mean, clearly they are looking over their shoulder and they just do not want to be outflanked on the right, which I think is part of the story of the last decade in terms of conservative media, is that no one wanted to be outflanked. You know, so part of the question is, what's more likely to happen now? I mean, now I'm shifting gears. Sometimes I jump around, but in terms of the direction the conservatives are going, are they more likely to strip Marjorie Taylor Greene of her committee assignments, or are they more likely to strip Liz Cheney of her chairmanship of the House caucus? I mean, I think that's one of those very, very clear issues. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a disgrace of the House of Representatives. Her comments alone, her behavior certainly warrants that she get the Steve King treatment. I mean, we've already known. I mean, the Republicans are capable of saying you're a bigot, you go too far, we're not going to have you on committees. Are they likely to do that with the Marjorie Taylor Greens or the Lauren Bobbitts? Or are they more likely to say, you know, to someone who has been decent and principled and done exactly what you and I are discussing here, excommunicating Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney, who stood up and said, look, we are all conservatives, but this is wrong. This is going too far. Those people are the ones who are being purged.
Okay, so again, I'll be the pessimist. I don't believe that the leadership.
I am the pessimist. No, I want to apologize if you think that I am more optimistic than you are.
You are more optimistic. You're arguing that this can be improved. I like it.
No, I'm saying it could be, but it's not happening. I mean, that right. the fact that I think that in an Earth 2.0, it is conceivable to imagine it happening, but the absence of it happening makes me deeply pessimistic. So. I would refer people to the transcript because I completely deny the baseless allegation, Mr. Salatin, that I am more optimistic than you are.
Okay, so I will take the pessimistic line here and say that I don't expect the leadership of the Republican Party to do the right thing. I just don't. They have not shown me that over in recent years. I believe they will go where inertia takes them. They will go take the path of least resistance. And that's what they've done. They're afraid of the Trump constituency. They're afraid of the Marjorie Taylor Greene constituency. They're just going to coddle that constituency as they did with the Steve King constituency as long as they can. At some point, it has to hurt, right? The Steve King thing had to just hurt to a point where they would strip him of his committee assignments. And the Marjorie Taylor Greene stuff just hasn't hurt enough. I mean, the 2020 election, look, I'm glad Donald Trump is gone. It would be a much worse country if he weren't. But we failed. We failed. Those of us who were trying to unseat Republicans, who were trying to expand the Democratic majority, we did take the Senate eventually, barely. But this needed to be a repudiation election, not just of Trump, but of the Republican Party, so that the forces within the Republican Party who wanted to reform it could have leverage to do so. And those of us who tried to administer the pain failed. They gained seats in the House. They got a 50-50 Senate. Look, I'm glad we won those two seats, but the forces of insanity in the Republican Party are pointing around and saying, we gained seats. This worked. And they're just going to keep coddling the Marjorie Taylor Greens and that whole group until it hurts.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's one of the really unfortunate developments of 2020 is that it hasn't hurt at the congressional level. In fact, I think that Kevin McCarthy, I think the conventional wisdom is that and Kevin McCarthy would agree with this, that the Republicans are well positioned to take control of the House next year. So why would they clean House? Why would they engage in the project of political hygiene and getting rid of the people who behave this badly? I keep hoping that at some point people will see this and go, we can't go in this direction. But as somebody who thought that Republicans were going off the rails 5 years ago, that seems quaint right now. It's amazing to me, I have to say, and you can accuse me of being naive. The speed with which the Republican Party has been corrupted and the intellectual infrastructure of the right has been absolutely destroyed. The speed and the thoroughness is really amazing that this could happen in just one presidential term.
Yeah. I mean, what Trump did was essentially to say, what if I don't follow the rules? Because Trump just didn't give a damn about any of the rules. What if I just pursue pure political advantage? What if I take the right wing line about military strength and the left's line about economic nationalism and put them together? What if I just thoroughly corrupt the government and turn it to my personal political ends? And it turns out he just didn't suffer much for that. So the people who want to stand up for the rules now have to make that hurt, right? The way you would do if you were dealing with a foreign aggressor, right? You have to make it hurt or they'll just keep expanding and exploiting. That's kind of what's, the latest theory, right, is that the insurrection itself will hurt Republicans in 2022. That's the thing. People dying because of this craziness will finally make it hurt politically in the Republican Party. I don't believe it. Show me. We're 2 years away from 2022. If it happens, great. I'll be excited. But I'm very skeptical that even the insurrection is going to hurt the Republican Party in the next round of elections.
No, I you keep in mind how far away that is, but also all of the lies about the election, the attempts to delegitimize the election, have been debunked in so many ways. You would think that would be a huge scandal, that there would be Republicans who would be chagrined about it. But my sense is that they are very much energized to double down on suppressing more votes, to make it harder to vote, that they think that the original sin of 2020 was it was too easy and too many of the wrong people got to the ballot box. And, by God, they're going to fix that by 2022. Including, unfortunately, some of the people who were the bulwarks of democracy this time around, some of the folks in Georgia who are not necessarily on the right side of all of these issues. And the way that the Republican Party has internalized the opposition to voting rights is really, that's another thing. It's just like, they at least used to pretend that this is what they were trying to do. And now it is so overt. So tell me, let's talk about impeachment for a while. For a moment, the vote yesterday it came as a shock to some people. Probably shouldn't have. 45 Republican senators went along with Rand Paul's bogus idea that it was unconstitutional to have a trial of a former official, despite the fact that there are historical precedents. To me, that was I don't think that more than a handful actually took the constitutional issue seriously. They just wanted to punt it. They just wanted to go away. They just do not want to cast that vote against Donald Trump.
Right, which is why they should have to cast that vote. It's why they should have to vote on the merits. They're taking Rand Paul is offering these Republican senators the easiest way out. Right, we're not even going to address the merits. We're just going to say that being a former president means you can't be impeached. Right, so of course they're going to take that. The argument against it is it's the Fifth Avenue defense, Charlie. There is nothing to which this theory would not apply, right? The president walks out on Fifth Avenue, shoots someone, gets impeached, his term ends before the Senate trial begins, and the argument would still apply, right? Now, of course, there you can prosecute the guy for murder, but even so, it's crazy how comprehensive this defense is. It's also, I don't agree with it on the merits either, but I don't think that shaming people by pointing this out is going to work, right? They're just going to shrug and turn away.
Right. No, we're definitely post-shame. John Cleese had a great tweet this morning. Let's see if I can actually find it, because it was really perfect. And I will mangle it if I don't read it exactly correct. He said, John Cleese, having dispensed with shame, most Republican senators now don't even bother to be hypocritical.
Right. There's, can I say, there's one other line about this that I'm really, I mean, part, when you go down this rabbit hole of coming up with endless excuses and rationalizations, one of the things you do is you just start stepping all over yourself, because you're hardly paying attention to what you're saying.
Yeah.
So the Joni Ernst argument, she put out her statement on this. It's simultaneously, number one, look, Trump is gone. He's no longer president. We don't need to worry about him, so we don't need to impeach, right? Impeachment wasn't designed for people who are no longer a threat. They're out of office. Right. And number two, how dare we tell people who they can vote for in the future by barring Trump from office by impeaching him? Well, obviously the two things are contradictory,
yes.
But Joni Ernst doesn't even take the time to think that through.
No, because a lot of this is, you know, I was listening to a lot of these debates, and I guess I've become very, very cynical that there is no fixed principle. It's just, you know, there's simply which cudgel you want to use at any given moment here. Now, you're seeing a lot of that. And of course, the other line, which is that it's so divisive. It is so, we can't divide the country over this. Like, have you people been paying attention to what's been going on for the last 4 years, not to mention the last 2 months, when you think about what the president of the United States did with all of the lying and the incitement, all of the conspiracy theories, all pitting one, you know, one American against another. And now it's suddenly yes, but we can't hold him accountable. That holding him accountable is more divisive than what he just did, seriously. So we were getting that argument out there. I guess, you know, part of it is, you know, this was the perfect way for the Republican Party to quit Donald Trump and move on, but they're not going to do it. I mean, it's like they've been liberated and they don't want to go. No, we're happy being Vichy. We are happy, you know, doing this. We are happy being held hostage to the lowest common denominator folks out there. I'm afraid. I was watching. By the way, I mentioned this. PBS Frontline had a fantastic documentary last night called Trump's American Carnage, and I make some cameo appearances. But you know, one of the things that stuck me with me was the scene that they had in there after he was acquitted from his first impeachment. He comes out in the White House and he holds up the Washington Post, and the big headline is Trump acquitted, and he was taking a victory lap. The way in which he felt absolutely emboldened, that he saw that as giving him permission to do anything. And you wonder, what are the consequences of Republicans, you know, watching everything that the president did, inciting this insurrection, 5 dead people, a dead cop, and acquitting him, that, you know, what now have you empowered? What signal have you sent now? Because it's not just, let's just move on, because you can't, as you point out, you're going to have to vote one way or another. And it's just not like, okay, we're done with that, because that's going to be a statement. And Donald Trump will use it, I'm afraid, to slingshot himself back into, I was going to say control of the Republican Party, but he's got control of the Republican Party.
Yeah. And this, to me, is one of the great tragedies and embarrassments of this time we're living in, that the Republican Party, which when I was a kid, fancied itself, presented itself as the party of strength, of standing up to dictatorship, standing up to aggressors. When the dictator or the would-be dictator arose in our own country and in their own party, they knuckled under, they appeased. They turned out to be just complete cowards. Even after he's out of office, they're afraid to cross him. And the lesson, they were right. They were right in what they said about aggressors, that if you try to appease the aggressor will take more and more. The aggressor will wave the Washington Post around and say, I was acquitted. I will go even further in this direction. They saw it and they liked it and they accepted it. And they are such cowards that he can leave the room and they are still haunted by his shadow. It's just a great embarrassment.
Yeah, that's kind of my reaction, that we've known it's been bad. It's been bad. It's been bad. It's been bad. And then suddenly over the last few days, it's like, oh, my goodness, it's even worse. They're even haunted by him. And he's down there sulking. He has no Twitter feed. He doesn't know what to do. He's probably, you know, binging on Ding Dongs. Who the hell knows? And yet they're still just afraid. I'll tell you something else that was kind of depressing for me last night was watching this PBS Frontline. And I said this to my wife, I said, did you notice the role that Paul Ryan plays in this? They had the various scenes of the last 4 years. Paul Ryan, who at one time was the intellectual and political leader of the Republican Party. And he was, for people who, you know, remember, he was vice presidential nominee. He was speaker by acclamation. He was regarded as the future of the Republican Party. He is reduced in the last 4 years to basically being in the chorus line. I mean, he's sort of back there, like, I, you know, just sort of cheering on and just smiling and, you know, a figure of no import whatsoever. And that's what Donald Trump has done to the Republican Party. So, Will, in the few minutes we have left, how do you think Joe Biden's doing in the first week? This is, believe it or not, he has been president for just 1 week.
I think Biden's doing fine. He should be doing fine, because it was left to him by the Trump administration to just represent sanity. And so most of what he has done in the first, I mean, like, how about if we start saving lives? How about if we stop losing 3,500, 4,000 people a day, needlessly to a disease? Mm-hmm. How about if we try to keep people from losing their apartments and their jobs? I mean, all of that is pretty straightforward stuff. So at this stage of the Biden administration, he should be doing fine, and he is doing fine, in my opinion.
Well, you have folks on the right who are saying that, well, wait, a lot of these executive orders seem to be punching woke buttons, you know, canceling the Keystone XL pipeline, stuff about, you know, gender studies, critical race theory. And I mean, you're seeing a lot of people, you know, on the right saying, well, how do you feel about your vote for him now? And I'll be honest with you, I agree with Mona Charon's got a great piece in Bulwark, but I agree with her that right now I'm still basking in the post-Trump era, the Trumpless America. That and going back to your article, I guess I am, and maybe this is an indictment of myself. Maybe I'm confessing something awful, that the right-left continuum doesn't motivate me as much as this vertical continuum of truth, decency, falsehood, you know, empathy, you know, liberal democracy, all of those things, which I feel we've escaped this narrowly. And it's refreshing, even when someone's wrong, to see somebody actually doing the job of governing. I mean, even if I disagree with you, I'm disagreeing with you within the parameters of normal politics, as opposed to what the hell, what fascist lunacy is he going to come up with next?
Right. I mean, the complaints that people have about Biden's little fibs here and there are refreshingly ancient. Like, that's what it used to be like when the president's, you know, when the lies were small, when the lies were negotiable, when it was a matter of spin and not just pure fabrication. So, I'm happy to see that return to normalcy. But I worry that Biden can't solve this problem. Biden actually can't provide the unity, because no. Biden he has to represent the left party in this country, right? It can be center left, but it's still on the left. And so we will not fundamentally solve this problem until the center right reestablishes itself, right? Until there is a constituency for or leadership. There needs to be a Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney, Bulwark, Dispatch, National Review, whatever the hell you want to call it, just like a center of gravity on the right that has enough of a political base and enough of an audience to make it feel safer to Republican politicians to stand up and say, we're not on the left and we believe in sanity and reality.
I completely agree. But also, let's face it, what Biden's got to do is he's got to succeed, because nothing succeeds like success. He's got to get the pandemic under control and he's got to get the economy back on its feet. If he does those two things, he will be able to do a lot of other things. If he fails at those two tasks, then everything in this project, including what you just mentioned, will fail. He's got to establish himself as somebody that can get something done. One last comment about Biden that really strikes me, and I think this is one of the advantages of being at his advanced age and experience, is that he's doing the job as opposed to being the job. You have a lot of other people like Donald Trump who wanted to just be president, and he was just sort of, you know, reveling in this, like, this is cool. Joe Biden walked in like, I've been here before. I've done this, and we've got a limited amount of time, and so let's just do stuff. Whereas, let's face it, that was not Donald Trump. Donald Trump was not interested in doing stuff, and we're living with the consequences as we speak. Will Salatin, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I appreciate it. I really appreciated your article, which people can go look up in Slate. The enemy isn't Republicans. It is liars. Will, thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.